This is Leslie Jenkins conducting an interview with Bob McTavish on the 2nd of November 2012 for the Surf World Museum at Currumbin. Bob, can I start by asking you your full name, including your middle name and your date and place of birth?
Robin Alastair McTavish. Robin spelled R-O-B-I-N. And I was born in Mackay, Queensland on the 14th of May 1944.
And I believe that you spent most of your years growing up, your early years in Brisbane, is that right?
Yep. Yeah, Dad moved us to Brisbane when I was about 9 or 10, from Toowoomba. We were in Toowoomba for a few years and then to Brisbane.
Well, Brisbane's a long way from the surf for people who like to surf. So what was your first introduction to surfing?
Well, Dad was already a surf addict. He'd been a body surfer all his life. So when we moved to, even from Toowoomba, we used to go to Maroochydore every year for school annual holidays. You know, in those days, you took 3 weeks or a month. You know how it was, and you'd be up there all January at Maroochydore. So I learnt to body surf when I was really young. But when we moved to Brisbane at age 9 or 10, every weekend we were down the coast. Dad had us in a little 10x10 George Pickers canvas tent. Eventually, there were 6 kids. The family grew. I was the second oldest. And we used to go down in this old Chevy Ute, a 1936 Chevy Ute, pile of kids in the back, sitting there in the wind blowing down the Pacific Highway. We knew every bend in the old Pacific Highway. Bounce across the Jubilee Bridge at Southport, down through Surfers Paradise, down to Currumbin, and right at Flat Rock, just south of Currumbin, is where we used to camp every weekend. And so surfboard adventures followed very quickly after that, not just body surfing, but because Dad bought a second-hand surfboard off the captain of the Currumbin Surf Club. £3 it cost, but it was smashed up in the rail because there's a clump of rocks just along the beach from the surf club at Currumbin, and the board smashed on those rocks. We call them magnet rocks because the boards always seem to go towards the rocks. So Dad paid £3 for the board. And we patched it up during the week with some cedar on the rail, and we started surfing that thing when I was 12.
And what was it made of?
It was plywood and with redwood rails, or probably actually Australian cedar, not redwood, be correct. The Australian cedar vertical sides on those old toothpicks, you know, it was an old 14-foot toothpick with a plywood deck and bottom.
And could you manoeuvre those boards at all?
Hated it. I hated the thing. The only thing I liked about it was the fact it paddled so well. You could get up and glide. And as a body surfer, you're used to just sitting in the impact zone next to the rocks at Currumbin, and you know you body surf to the beach. But once you're on the surfboard, you were up and you had the power over the ocean that you could paddle way out and sit beyond the break. And that was a revelation. Being up high and seeing everything coming. That was the only good thing about that board. As soon as you paddle onto a wave, the thing would skew sideways, flip and nosedive, and you'd swim to the beach to pick it up off the rocks at Magnet Rocks. You know, it was a horrible, horrible surfboard. In fact, I hated it so much that I went home and made myself a plywood bodyboard out of pine sugar, like a fruit box. I used fruit box rails, and it was about 40 inches long, about 3'6" long. And it had plywood deck and bottom, and I rode that in preference, just because I could surf on it on my belly, on a hollow. It was a hollow box type structure.
So that was the first board you shaped?
Yes, when I was 12. Yeah, that's it.
And was your father encouraging of what he could obviously see was a developing passion for you?
Absolutely. Yeah, Dad. I mean, Dad got roped in to the Commonwealth Bank and. Yeah, you know, he originally started the bank in Sydney. He was body surfer. He comes from Atherton Tableland up in North Queensland, but moved to Sydney with the bank, and that's where he learned to body surf. So he just loved the surfing life. You know, he was down the beach every morning when he was a young fellow in his early 20s and late teens, and he was body surfing at Ben Buckler. Just loved surfing. And in fact, just while I'm on the topic, you know, when he died at age 92, that's right, didn't quite make the 93, but at 92, he my wife leaned over him in the nursing home and said, "Dad, what do you think about when you're coming in and out of consciousness?" Because he kept fading, you know. And he looks up at her and he goes, and she's leaning over him. I thought he was going to say sex, but he says, "Surf." That's about the last word I ever heard out of my dad. He was a surf junkie, you know, all his life. And so when my older brother Peter and I got addicted to surfboards, I was 12, Pete was 13, going on 14. He was only too glad to encourage it.
Was your brother Pete involved in all the escapades that you were as you became more and more addicted, if you like, to surfing?
Pete took off travelling very young. He was in the surf club. He joined Caloundra Surf Club. And so when I left, well, Mum and Dad moved from Brisbane back to Toowoomba, so that Pete and I ended up in a flat in Woolloongabba in Brisbane, and we, you know, the Gabba was just a Russian suburb in those days. You know, it was rough and tumble, and really a great place to grow up, really, because it had incredible food, and you know, we were adventurous, and we'd try all the foods in the local deli and so on. But Pete joined Caloundra Surf Club, so I followed him. But Pete left at about 17 to hit the world, and he ended up living in Hong Kong most of his life. So, no, our adventure, our ways parted when he was 17, I was 16.
And what about your other siblings? Did they develop an interest in surfing?
Young brother Andy started surfing. He's 12 years younger, and he started surfing in the 70s, and he got pretty good. He still lives around here, and he surfs occasionally, but he never was an addict like I was.
Yeah. Was your family a religious family?
No, absolutely not. Dad hated religion because of the Second World War, conscripting, the churches were conscripting people and getting them killed in the Second World War. So he tossed the baby out with the bathwater. He tossed the Bible out with it. And, I mean, I believe in the Bible, but I don't believe in religion. So I think religion's the worst force on earth. You know, it's corrupted and divisive and warmongering. So, you know, I hate religion, but even though I'm a Jehovah's Witness, we think religion stinks. Mm. You know.
So when you started going to the club at Caloundra, were you a member of the Surf Lifesaving Club there?
Well, the only way you could get to really stay in the surf club for free on the weekends was to plug into the system, you know. So from age 14 onwards, I was going up every week hitchhiking to Caloundra from Brisbane, staying in the surf club, and you progressed. I was a cadet, and you progressed to become a junior, and you get your bronze medallion when you're 16, and then you qualify to do patrols, etc. So yeah, I did the whole thing until I took off to Sydney when I was 17.
And what did you learn from that experience, though? Did you learn how to read the waves, or how?
We already had that from body surfing at Currumbin. Yeah, we understood rips and sandbank patterns, and at Caloundra, I had surfboards, and that was the big progress. I mean, I bought a second-hand beat-up balsa board, stripped the glass off it, and got it reshaped it. And so from age 14 onwards, I had surfboards. And at the surf club at Caloundra, there were quite a few guys who were keen to learn how to ride surfboards and get serious about it. So that was the big thing about the surf club, was every weekend we were chasing waves according to the wind. It was a southerly, we were around at Moffat Heads, it was a nor'easter, we were at King's Beach, and we were hunting every little spot in between. And then an influential character appeared, Pa Bendel, who started surfing in 1959, and Pa Bendel, he wasn't in the surf club. They owned a block of flats in around Golden Beach, not Golden Beach, around in Caloundra. And he was an ex-Canadian Air Force pilot, and he got enraptured by surfing. And so he made, straight up, he made some epoxy and polystyrene surfboards, one for him and one for his wife. And he painted Ma on one and Pa on the other, and these big, ugly, but super light foam boards. And I picked up a friendship with him, because my weekend stretched into, Mondays not making it back to Brisbane, you know, and so there was no one else to surf with for him on Mondays or weekdays. So, and then whenever I had holidays from work, I'd always be at the surf club. So I became his surf buddy sort of 5 days a week, and the surf club guys on the weekend. And Pa had money, and he had a nice big Ford Fairlane wagon, and so he took me to Noosa for the first time, took me down and surfed Kira for the first time, all from Caloundra, you know, and he took me to the first surfboard factory in Queensland, which was at Mermaid Beach. That was Roger Duck Kieran. Roger Kieran had a balsa surfboard factory in Mermaid Beach.
And did this predate the surfboard manufacturing enclave, if you like, at Brookvale in Sydney?
Concurrent, same time. And so when I saw... So, yeah, Pa Bendel sort of opened my eyes that there was a whole world of surf out there. And then the next event that really hit me hard was... I went to the New Farm Theatre in Brisbane to see surf movies. Bruce Brown travelled with Phil Edwards, must have been 61 or 62, and they showed movies of Hawaii, and the first Surfer magazine had appeared.
What was that called?
Oh, just Surfer.
Oh, yeah.
And it was published in black and white, and it was to go with John Severson from California, from San Clemente, and it was to go with his film called The Big Surf. And so this magazine was designed to promote his movie, but he labelled it Surfer. And it became Surfer magazine, which is still probably the world's preeminent surf magazine, and 50 years later. But John, anyway, so we had surf magazines. So we'd seen photos of Hawaii and California and all these names. And when the movies arrived in 61 with Phil Edwards and Bruce Brown, we saw them on the big screen. We just went, you know, there's so much, it's a whole world out there, you know, let's go. I just wanted to go and devour surfing and travel. But
there wasn't any real surf culture then, was it? Because
no.
you're talking about the
surf clubs.
The 50s, aren't you?
Well, there was no surf culture until 60, 61.
Mm. And then, just to digress for a minute, were you too young in 56 to go down and see the American...
I was only 12, yeah.
Yeah, the lifeguards that came to Avalon and then went to Torquay.
You didn't even know about them until later. You didn't even know it happened. The press wasn't like it is today, you know.
Mm.
Information was slow getting around in those days.
Mm. So seeing the surf movie, that must have been absolutely amazing for you to see that there were all these other people doing things on different sorts of boards.
Exactly. And it's so much fun. You know, the first surf movies were just funny and the life just looked incredible, you know. I mean, I worked briefly when I was 14, I started in an advertising agency and I was studying advertising, but that dropped off and I went to a radio station because to me it was more upfront with like I was really interested in media and etc. And I was ready to go into a
which radio station
4BH Brisbane.
Yeah,
and I was ready to go at 17 when I chucked it all in, or I got the sack actually, but when I was ready to chuck it all in and just go surfing, I was plugged in ready to start at BTQ Channel 7. I was going to start on the floor as a cameraman, and I had ambitions of working my way up into production and producing, directing television. But at 17, when I got the sack from 4BH, I went, I'm going surfing. And so I just went, bang, I'm a full-time surfer from now on.
So being a full-time surfer then, how did you survive? Because lots of surfers survived in the 70s who were full-time because they could get unemployment benefits, but you couldn't get that then, could you?
If you went to the police station and filled some forms out and you waited around long enough, a couple of weeks or more, you could end up getting £3 a week or something, which I never bothered with. I got a job, first of all, in a bakery, working from 10 o'clock at night until I fell asleep in the flour bags, you know, whatever that was, 4 a.m. in the morning. And go surfing the rest of the day. It was my first job as a surf rat, you know. But that only lasted a few weeks. Then I took off to Sydney and ended up in the surfboard factory straight away. At age 17, I became a sander.
Was that in one of the ones in Brookvale?
Yep. I moved to Brookvale and it was all on, you know. It was.
Who were you working for there?
I lasted half a day with Greg McDonough. He said, "You can shape, can you?" I said, "Yeah, I can shape." He gave me the wrong tool to shape with, and I didn't even know, you know. So he gave me a vibrator sander, and gave me a blank, and you couldn't do anything with it, you know. I wanted an electric planer, but I thought he must know. So he gave me the wrong tool and went, well, if I don't know the right tool, get out of here. So I didn't last there long. So I walked around to Scotty Dillon's, and I'd already made friends with a guy called Minnie Mouse, who travelled with Bruce Brown showing the movie up in Brisbane. And so that, when I saw the surf movie, right, it was a week later, I'm in Sydney and banging on my mate's door, Minnie Mouse, who I'd met at the movie. And Minnie Mouse was just like me, total surf rat, and he had no... And me, just like me, he was totally footloose. He had no permanent address and no possessions, so the same as me. But he was sanding at Scotty Dillon's. He had a surfboard stashed in a guy called Mexican, who's around here. A Mexican's mum and dad had a house at North Avalon. So I took my board with me and when I got ride to Sydney, and he caught up with Minnie Mouse. We left our boards in Mexican's garage, and we slept wherever we could, ate wherever we could, hitchhiked to work at Scotty Dillon's after surfing at Avalon in the morning. And
is,
then,
is that when you lived in the car at Avalon?
We got the car, lived in the car at Avalon. That worked for a couple of months.
But I might get you to tell that story, because I think it's amazing that the car was in the car park there for 6 weeks, and you put mud on the windows so that you wouldn't...
We get woken up. Light.
Can you imagine doing anything like that now?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy.
It'd just be impossible.
Yeah, well, how that came about was a guy called Lee Cross that did the first surfer magazine in Australia. And Lee hung out with all our gang. So in Sydney, this is the amazing bit. In Sydney, we knew every surfer in Sydney. Every surfer in Sydney in 1961. Is that believable?
Because there weren't many. But they were surfing. Wasn't there a bit of a difference between surfers who surfed in the eastern suburbs, like Bronte, Maroubra, Tamarama, that sort of area, and the surfers who surfed on the northern suburbs from, you know, Manly up to Palm Beach?
I tell you how it was. It was Saturday morning at DY Beach, Arthur's Milk Bar, the park across there from there. Every decent surfer in Sydney would roll up on Saturday morning at DY. And they were from Cronulla, Maroubra, Bondi, Palm Beach, Collaroy, Longreef, Narrabeen. Everyone just congregated at DY because that was epicentre. Midget Farrelly was the best surfer in Australia. That's where he hung out. Nat was the up-and-coming brat at Collaroy. He'd come down with a guy called Bob Kennison, who was 17, had old enough to drive him down. Nat was only 13. All the surfboard workers at Brookvale would always be there on Saturday morning. That's when the shops were selling boards too. They'd take orders on Saturday morning, make the boards during the week, and the guys would pick them up. So Brookvale, DY, right next to each other. So everybody would hang around a bit at DY, drinking milkshakes, had a few beers, not before someone would be seeding a few stories. And then you'd set off to find the best wave on the North Shore, the Northern Beaches. It might be 15 or 20 cars go en masse. It might be Long River, it was a nor'easter, or Narrabeen, all the way to Palm Beach, it was a big south swell. Just this stream of cars with four, five, six boards strapped to the roof and seven or eight bodies in each car. You know, that's the way it was. And you'd arrive at a break, there'd be 40 or 50 of you, and one big mob would roll up. And then you'd hang there for hours, you know, as kids do. And you wouldn't all hit the water at the same time, you know. You'd just be hanging around. Some would go straight away, some a bit later. But every decent surfer from Cronulla was there. Every decent surfer from Bondi was there. And so on. That's how we knew. Everybody knew each other. Saturday night, it was either DY pub or later on the Newport Arms. And you'd just take over the joint with all these surfers. And they're all friends. They're all stout. They all got stories to tell. And you see a car on the road with boards, you'd wave and stop and ask where they're from. And, you know, that was just the way it was.
Yeah. And were you in Sydney for the first World Championships in 1964? Midget Farrelly won that, and Phyllis O'Donnell won the women's.
Yep.
So was that something you were competing in?
No, I wasn't interested. What I was interested in was the fact that it attracted Phil Edwards from California, who was head judge. It attracted Joey Cabell from Hawaii, who was a brilliant surfer. Mike Doyle from California, great, great, great surfer. Little John Richards from California. Plus Gordon Burgess from England and some South African guys. And I was interested in these guys as surfers and their stories. And so it was good to hang around that event. I don't think I was on the beach for the final. I don't think I bothered to watch it. I wasn't that interested in the actual contest. It was the people and their stories of surf. That's what I was intrigued by.
And when you were living this lifestyle, did you have a strategic plan, even though you wouldn't have called it that, but where you wanted to go? Or were you living just each day for the surf that happened that day?
Day by day, yeah. So one thing that people forget was that the Cold War was raging. The Cold War was, the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis were terrifying. To me, they were. I mean, I saw a show recently and they reckoned it was only like a 15% chance that the world would have escalated into nuclear war. But to me, it was game on. It was nuclear war.
So did that affect your thinking that this day might be my last, so why worry about the future?
Absolutely. And I was suspect of the system anyway, right from my dad was good because he was a bit of a rebel, you know. He didn't like the system, the way it worked. And I could tell he was frustrated. He'd been caught up by working in the bank. So when dad quit the bank when I was 10 to move to Darwin, and he packed the whole family into a rotten old caravan, and he'd quit the bank. And as he walked out that day from the bank, they had a party for him, because he was number two at the Commonwealth Bank at Toowoomba. He pulled the fire extinguisher off the wall and sprayed the whole place with the contents of the fire extinguisher and everybody and everything. And they said, "Well, why'd you do that for?" And he said, "I always wondered what it was like." I mean, that's my dad, you know. Like, I come from that stock that we don't really go along with the regular routine and the Bob Menzies and, you know, plug in and get your financial advice and buy your house and then go into retirement and rot and die. We never bought into that package, you know.
What about your mum, though? I mean, she kind of kept things together too, didn't she, if there were six kids?
Yeah, super hard worker and lovely.
And did she think that... Was she worried at all, though? Were living such a...
No.
Unanchored life?
No, I think she got used to it. I mean, she knew that my dad wanted that life himself and that he'd sacrificed it for the kids. So... She was up for it too. Mm. Yeah. Naturally, she was concerned when I stayed away to Hawaii, what was going to happen. But she was she realised that's the way it was living with Austin McTavish. That's what was going to happen with Robbie McTavish, you know. It was and Peter, you know, we were going to be wild guys who had no trust in the regular system.
Yeah, and how did you develop the idea to go to Hawaii? How did that come about? Why did you want to go there?
I found a book when I was working 4BH in 1959. I picked up there was a book in the bookstore downstairs, and it had underneath the radio station, and it had photos of Hawaii, black and whites. You know, and it was called The Big Surf, the book, and so I bought it immediately. You know, even though I was only getting £7 a week. I somehow bought the book for £3 or whatever it was, because it was just gold. It had photographs of Sunset Beach and Makaha, heaps of photographs of Waikiki, and it just opened my eyes that there were waves as big as telephone poles in Hawaii. And when I was the office boy walking around the streets, when I'd be at the radio station, and I'd look at telegraph poles and then broaden them out and said, "That's how big the waves are over there." And I'd be doing my errands, running around the town, visualising these giant waves as big as city buildings. And so I wanted to go to Hawaii since 1959. I was keen as right away to see these giant waves and surf them. Plus, the water was sparkling, and it's tropical. Even the black and white photos, it had that atmosphere that this is where they surf headquarters.
Had you ridden any big waves, say, in winter time in Australia?
That's a Caloundra was my spot, and it surfed Kira, big Kira, like it was double overhead Kira. and a surf coming under Moffat's head's as big as it possibly gets. You know,
but that's not as big as Hawaiian
no
waves,
way.
Is it?
No, no way. And we always dreamed of riding big waves. So when I went to Sydney, I rode everything big. And we rode Queenscliff Bommy, we rode big Newport Reef. I've even had a trip to Bells before that and rode giant Bells, you know, the biggest we could get. So I was ready for Hawaii because it was going to be bigger and better, and it was.
Was it scary, though?
No.
I mean, to see waves as big as...
No, Hawaii's not scary. Hawaii's got deep channels. You paddle out in deep coral channels in tropical water that's just like bath water. That's not scary. That's just comfort zone, you know. And so even the biggest days that we encountered in that stowaway trip, I was there for 5 weeks, the biggest waves we encountered were all comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people weren't using leg ropes there, were they?
No.
They hadn't been introduced.
No.
Do you think the introduction of the leg rope made much difference to surfing generally? Did it
yeah.
encourage more beginners to get out amongst the bigger waves? Or
yes. Yes. It's a bit of a shame because the skill of hanging onto your board or swimming after it, you know, we were really fit because we were always swimming after our boards. And now it was a bit of a shame for people who could hardly swim with surfing, that's all. It just lowered the standard of surf understanding, of ocean logic, you know. That sort of was lowered dramatically by the introduction of the leg rope.
Mm. Now tell me a bit about stowing away. You already had some friends that were going on that boat.
Yeah.
Were they going over for a competition?
No. I mean, there was every year there was the annual Makaha contest, which once again you would probably go and have a look at because you'd see all the names from California would be there, and so you'd be interested to rub shoulders with the best, you know, the world's best surfers would all gather in December for the Makaha event. But that wasn't the reason. The reason was just to go ride beautiful waves. And the travel bug and so on. And you couldn't fly in those days. And air flights were far too expensive, so everyone went on ships.
Yes. So that ship that you went on, the
Orsova,
was that taking holiday makers to Hawaii, or was it? It wasn't an immigrant ship, was it? It was going from Australia just to Hawaii or further?
It went on to Los Angeles, then on to Vancouver, and that's as much as I know, because
yes.
we made friends with the girl heading to Vancouver.
And did it hold many people?
Oh, that's a good question.
Just trying to get a sense of it, like liners now are huge.
Oh, nothing like that. No, I'm guessing around probably 500-600 people.
Right.
And yes, it was the main connection between Australia and North America. And so there would be immigrants on board, definitely. There'd be business people, you know, that's the way you would travel if you want to set up some business overseas. You'd travel for a few weeks on a boat, a couple of weeks on a boat to get over there.
So you would have looked like the surfer you were, I guess.
Yeah, we're just nuggety little blonde guys.
And there were some other surfies, but I guess all the surfies on the boat would have been 10? I'm just trying to
ten. There was
out.
10 all up.
Yeah,
about
it would have
10.
Been not that difficult to identify you.
Very easy. Very easy to spot us. Yeah,
given that everybody else looked different.
Exactly.
But anyway, so you went to visit the people on the boat and then you never got off.
That's right. Simple. I got the sack from Scotty Dillon that day because in the morning, because I'd been just even worse at showing up, you know. I was bad at showing up any time, but I just kept travelling up to Queensland whenever someone was going, or there's a cyclone to head to Noosa, you know, just hitchhike with somebody or convince someone they should go, you know, just jump in their car and head off. And so Scott finally got sick of it and just went, no, can't have you around anymore, Bob, you know, here's 10 quid, go, don't come back. And I knew the guys were leaving that afternoon and went, well, I just might go to Hawaii.
And simple as that.
Yeah.
You had £10.
I had 10 quid. Yeah, it's a lot of money then. That'd be equal to what today, you know, a couple of $100?
That's not much to go to Hawaii with.
Anyway, a lot to me.
So so the friend that you went with was Dave...
Dave Chidji.
Chidji.
Yeah. Chidji, he's a character.
Is he? Do you still know him?
It's a hard one to answer because... How can I protect him? I can't answer that question.
But he's still in
yes.
Australia.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. So So tell me about the experience. You were protected in a way by the boys who did have paid tickets.
Yeah, there were four of them sharing a F deck, you know, way down the bottom, you know. And four of them had, there were four bunks, and three of them were Maroubra, Natch and Ugg and Bobcat. And Natch and Ugg and Bobcat, and we were welcome to sleep under their bunks. You know, like at this level, we could slide underneath on
about
the floor.
About half a metre or less.
A foot, 10 inches to a foot. Yeah. So we could lay flat on our backs and just be face against their mattress, you know. But that's just fine for 10 nights. Yeah.
Didn't take long, did it, to get there, really?
No. New Zealand, nights. Auckland first, then Fiji,
and
then into Honolulu.
Yeah. And the interview that I listened to that you did with
Richard Weidler,
you said that, you know, when you got to, you know, there were various things that you did when they had checks for stowaways, standing on toilets and then running out. But there was a woman who helped you, really, wasn't there? When it came time, everyone else had got off, but you hadn't.
We were... Getting off was harder than getting on, by far.
But you've got immigration to contend with.
You can't just slip down a rope, as Chidji wanted to just climb down a rope and get out of there, but you know, you get busted straight away. Plus, they did a stowaway search. When you land, they do a stowaway search. All the Indian stewards have to go check the boat from one end to the other after the departing passengers get off. So Patsy, who was going on to a proxy marriage in Vancouver...
Was she Indian?
No, she's an Aussie girl from Sydney. And she'd just written heaps of letters back and forward to this guy in Vancouver, and they were going to get married. Hadn't met. So she was terrific, and she stashed us while they were doing the search on the ship. Gigi and I ran down there, realised what was going on, and she hid us in her clothes cupboard, which was simply a curtain over a little space. And we were standing behind this curtain while the Indian steward was trying to get in and inspect the room. But... she stuck to her guns and wouldn't let him in. He could stick his head and have a look around, but didn't let him in the room to search. And so he moved on. But she, you know, she saved us from getting busted, definitely.
And so after that incident, did you just go up? Oh, she gave you a piece of paper, though, didn't she?
Yeah, we asked her to go to the purser's office and ask for two passes to let visitors from Hawaii, Honolulu, come on board for the day. So she went and got those passes. And she walked off the boat, went through immigration just as a mock, you know. Walked back on after an hour. Then we hid for the next until three. We berthed at 8 a.m. We hid until 3 o'clock because they had to give time for these supposed visitors to come on and visit Patsy, and then we would walk off, and she'd wave us goodbye down the gangplank. And so we had to wait until. Names and faces were blurred in the minds of the immigration people a bit, because we didn't want them saying, we didn't see you walk on with anybody, you know, to Patsy. And we had to wait at a time that when the crew were at one end of the gangplank and the immigration guys were at the other. Often they were just intermingling and talking and sharing a cigarette and so on. You had to wait until they separated, because a lot of the guys on the boat knew us and thought we were passengers. So We waited for that moment. It didn't come until 3 p.m. We're up on the A deck looking down. When we saw the opportunity, we said, right, here we go. So down to B deck, down to C deck, down to the gangplank. Shook hands with the officers. And they said, well, good luck in the Makaha contest and stuff, and good on you. Walked across the gangplank and gave our passes to the immigration guys that we were Americans visiting for the day. Bunged on American accents and said, you know, thank you very much. Bye-bye. See you. Have a great day. And walked out of the joint. It was well handled, you know. Yeah. Well engineered.
But you do think you were known about, don't you? Because didn't someone follow you?
One of the ship's officers. We walked in Honolulu Harbour. There's a walkway that goes right along the docks. And we didn't know where we were, you know. We just had to get away from the place. So we started walking along the pathway beside the dock, past the ship. There's the form of the ship going by. And the Aloha Tower's behind us. And then a white uniform pops around the corner, and I did. First, it was just footsteps I just heard behind us, and I said, Chidgey, someone's behind us. So I bent down and had a look, fooled around with my shoe and had a look. That's a white uniform. Kept walking on. And I said, Chidgey, it's one of the ship's officers. And he goes, well, let's run. I said, no, there's no point. Look, they'll get us, whatever. So we might as well just face it. Let's see what's cooking. So he stopped. The guy walked up to us with a big grin. He said, so you made it, eh, fellas? I went, what? You knew? And he goes, yeah, some of us were on here. I said, oh, fantastic. He said, no, go on, have fun, you guys. So some of the officers knew that there were some, the numbers didn't add up. There was only 7 paying passengers and there were 9 or maybe 10 of us hanging around in a gang, you know. So someone did the figures and went, no, it's not
it
right.
It was a particular time, wasn't it, when do you think Australians were different or just that there's become so many more rules governing what we all do,
yeah,
that they would be forced to report you now?
Well, I found the Yanks pretty friendly that era too. Yeah. I think it's just the world's changed.
The world's changed.
Yeah.
And so before you left for America, for Hawaii, you were eating bread and banana sandwiches and trying to get food and drink from any way you could.
Yeah.
So what did you do in Hawaii? You didn't have the same contacts to help you get food. So what did you do then?
Right away, we scored painting for $1 an hour. There was a guy called Val Valentine who made a surf movie in 1962, and we saw the movie in Australia. I actually met Val and travelled to Noosa with Val Valentine and a guy called Lester Bryan, they should write 10 books about Lester Bryan. He is one hell of a character, just lives in town here. So I knew Val Valentine. So when we got there, walked up to his house, g'day Val, how you going? Met his wife and blah, blah, blah. And he said, yeah, he wanted to get his house painted. We were happy to do it for $1 an hour. So Dave Chidgey and I became house painters. And it took us a couple of dollars to... $1 a day would do it easily, you know, on bread and bananas. We were in luxury. We could get peanut butter and honey as well, you know. So, but their bread was rubbish, you know, that sweet trash they call bread over there. But yeah, we survived just fine because we
painted his house. Did you have to eat any spiders over there?
No spiders eating there. That was
no spider
except
eating.
That for Newport Pub. Oh, plus there were passion fruit growing wild everywhere, and the Hawaiians didn't eat them in those days. And guavas and passion fruit grew wild everywhere, and no one was into it.
Oh.
You know, being a Queenslander, they're just endlessly just pulling passion fruit and popping them and guavas. Mm.
So where were you sleeping?
An old house. The boys, the three, Najat, Natch, Ug and Bobcat, rented. They went to Camiland and asked if they could rent a house. And the guys, Camiland's a little market. Sorry, Cammy's market, run by a Japanese family, who became friends with. And Cammy knew everybody because every surfer in the world walked into his little shop. But Cammy found an empty house on Sunset Point. And the boys paid like $3 a week to stay there. And it had no furniture. But I got some cardboard cartons from the back of Cammy's market and carried them out there, and that became our mattress. The temperature's perfect, didn't need a blanket. So we'd just sleep on cardboard cartons for the next 5 weeks. It was fantastic. Cardboard cartons, surf breaking right out front, Sunset Beach.
Mm.
And here's a good thing, was one of the guys... actually, Natch and I both bought guns with them, big wave guns. But turns out they didn't like big waves that much. And they also had small wave boards, you know, which were long boards in those days. And they'd go to Makaha almost every day around the other side because it's smaller and protected. And they'd drive around the old bomb they bought. So Chidgey and I would work painting the house. We'd paint the roof when the surf was good so you could watch it, you know. And then we'd paint the walls when the surf wasn't any good. And when it was just right, down with brushes, scramble down, grab out the guns that they weren't riding, and we'd head out sunset by ourselves. So Dave and I surfed sunset alone, just day after day after day. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the school teachers and firemen, which were the main surf occupations, you know, would come down and surf until dark. But through the day, no one there.
Mm.
Pretty much. There was one or two other guys here and there, but
yeah,
mostly Dave and I surfed by ourselves at sunset.
And were there any women surfing in Hawaii?
In that era, there was, around at Makaha side, there was, let's see, there was a family, There was Joyce Hoffman was there, a young girl, and she, her dad was very wealthy. He owned a fabric company. The Quicksilver still buys fabric off, Hoffman's. And there was a family, Mother Marge and her two daughters, Robin and Candy, from California. So they, the Calhoun family. So that was four Howley girls. And certainly there were a few local girls. I think Rel's son was probably too young to surface at that stage, but there were certainly quite a few local Hawaiian girls surfing at Makaha.
Mm.
Sunset, no. No girls.
And what were the boards like when you were surfing in Hawaii, the American boards compared to the Australian boards?
Well, I must admit they were beautiful pieces of art, but that's all they were. That's where they belonged, was on the wall. I mean, they'd hardly embraced foam. Most guys were still riding balsa boards, and they were so heavy. And Dick Brewer was the leading shaper. Another guy called Bob Shepherd made good boards too, but they were into these big rolly bowl noses, which were more like hulls, and very stiff rocket tails with hard edges in the back. And these were the big elephant guns. And to me, they were the dumbest thing I ever saw. It was all back the front. You know, they had these big, slow, pushy noses and these very fast tails, and frequently the nose would contact and the tail would just overtake it. It would just spin out. But the board I got was shaped by Midget Farrelly. The gun, this was Ugg's gun, 10 foot 6, 10 foot 4 or 10 foot 6, I can't remember the exact inches. But it had a flat bottom and sensible rails and a little bit of rocker. And frankly, I think, you know, Midget was way ahead of his time on that board. And the board that Chidji rode was made by Jackson at Cronulla. He's still got a surfboard business there now. And it had a bit of roll on the front and it was a bit dead. My board was lively and crisp. Mm. And
what about fins in those days?
Well, most of them were still keel-type fins, and the guns had very long keel fins. And the Midget fin was more modified. Small wave fins were still based around D-shaped templates. Or a thing was called the Phil fin was out, and that was designed by Phil Edwards, who was the world's best surfer in small waves at that time. And his fin looked just like a Hobie Cat, with a foresail and a mainsail, because he designed the Hobie Cat too. So the Phil fin looked just like a Hobie Cat in the full sail.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were all off beam, no good fins.
Yeah. So when did you start to think that you wanted to make shorter boards and change the shape of them?
Well, I was fortunate that I tumbled into a short board in 1960 or 59. When I was 15, 59 or 60. There was a surf shop opened in Brisbane run by a guy from the Kira Surf Club. His name was Kenny Wiles.
That was in Elizabeth Street, wasn't it?
No, that was later. He was originally in King George Square.
Oh, right. King George Square.
Yeah, next to the Tivoli Theatre.
Right.
Opposite the Town Hall, or the City Hall.
Mm.
And his little surf shop, I mean, he carried towels, Speedos, and a range of six or eight surfboards. I don't know how he ever made a living. He had nothing to sell. But one day, I used to rock in there every day because I was an office boy running around town. And I walked into his little shop one day and there was a 6 foot six board there. And I said, well, you know, what's this? At this stage, I was riding my reshaped balsa board. But I walked in and I saw this little 6 foot six board. I said, what's that thing? And he said, it's called a goose board. And oh, yeah. I said, how much is that one? He said, well, it's £21. And the regular boards are £27. And I was keen to get off balsa and into foam. So I said, well, you know, maybe that's for me, you know. I'm a little bloke, maybe I can get away with a 6'6". He said, yeah, perfect. Give me your money. And so I started putting down $10 a week, 10 shillings a week, and until I paid this thing off, £21. Came the Friday that I paid it off, I put it under my arm and caught the tram to Chermside and hitchhiked to Caloundra with the board. And you could do that with a 6 foot six board. You can jump on a tram. So that was a revelation right there. And you could hitchhike with it. So I rode that board until I went to Sydney and worked for Scotty Dillon's. So I was already riding a 6'6". And when I got down to Sydney, you know, everybody said, oh, you've got to get a real board. And so eventually I caved in and went straight to a 10-footer because they were trendy then, big boards. But I said, when I first got to Sydney, they were all paying me out of my little 6 foot six. I go, don't worry, one day you'll all ride 6 foot sixes. You know, you'll all wise up, you'll all wise up. Because they were so loose and pivoty, but you couldn't nose ride, you couldn't. And that was the big deal, was walking the board and nose riding. So that's why I cashed it in for a real 10 footer. So, but I'd already had in the back of my mind that, you know, short boards could turn like crazy. But they weren't that good. They weren't good for walking on, you know.
Yeah.
You just had the trim. So that was in 1959, 60, 61. Came 64 when I got a job. After the World Contest, I moved to Hayden Kenny, offered me a job. And it was right near Noosa. It was at Alexandra Heads. And Noosa was, in my mind, the best wave in Australia by then. I got to realise that. I first surfed in 59. And I'd been back many times, and so I wanted to live there and surf perfect point waves. So Hayden offered me a job shaping, and the glasser was Bob Cooper from California, and Bob's friend George Greeno came visiting, and I hit it off with George like that, and George is one unique character.
He was a knee boarder.
Exactly.
Did he ever ride other boards?
He made in 1960, he made himself a stand-up board about 7 foot six long, but he didn't like it. He liked knee surfing because he was close to the wave. So George ripped on his knee board, his little 4 foot long knee board, or 4 foot eight it was, and he just slashed the wave apart, you know, and went, oh, that's what I want to do standing up. So I immediately raced into Hayden's and made myself a copy of it and took it out in the beach breaks, and it went terrible because they used the 10 foot boards at 9.6s, and this thing just went like a dog. Plus at the same time, you'd had Joey Cabell visited Australia months before and surfed unbelievable in the World Contest. And Mickey Dora was our hero from California now. He'd sort of replaced Phil Edwards because Dora had the personality and the attitude. You know, he was a rebel. And we'd pick him up in the magazines and we'd seen a little bit of movie footage of him. And so he always wanted to be Dora, you know. And he had the classic walking and trimming and surfing Malibu, you know, waves this big, just like Noosa. So we all had this Dora fixation going. So when George came along and shredded on a little 4 foot eight, I wasn't ready to embrace that. I liked it, made a board and copied it and tried it, but it went pretty dumb because it was a small wave, small board. But once I got out of it, it took me another 3 years until 67 and I finally went, okay, now I want to go vertical. I want to get boards that will carve vertical on the face. I'd already had that 6.6 in 1960. 61. I already had the George Greeno 4 foot eight that I'd made in 1964. I'd been surfing with George every winter, 64, 65, 66, 67. George was around every year, come and stay with us. So I was ready. And so it came 67, we started cutting boards down. I started making shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. Till by the end of 67, we were riding 7 foot sixes in Australia, 7.6 to 8 foot. The rest of the world was still riding 10 footers. And then the year after that, you know, 68, we got down to 6 foot four. 69, we discovered flat planing bottoms. We all the while, George gave us a great fin template in 64 and flexed tip fins laid up on sophisticated fin panel. So we had good fins right through the mid to late 60s. And by 1970, you know, we had fabulous single fin surfboards wired. So there was a massive leap from 67 through to 1970.
And were materials also changing during that period?
Not really.
So that didn't change. And what about...
We just got better at using them.
Right.
We made lighter and lighter blanks, lighter and lighter glassing of surfboards.
And what about the equipment you were using?
Same.
We so still you didn't use the same get better tools. Planers and better...
Not yet. We still use pretty old basic stuff, you know. The Yanks always had skill planers, which were nicer. They had adjustable thickness, but we didn't have that. No, I still use very basic tools.
Do you? So it hasn't changed that much over the last couple of decades?
The computer shapes come in. In the last 10 years, computer shapes have taken over. 98% of boards now are pre-shaped through a computer.
Right.
Which I don't do that still. But we do quite a lot for our company that way, but I'm in the 2% bracket where full hand shapes.
You do custom boards?
Yep. Full hand shapes. Start with a raw blank, and same as I always did.
Yeah.
And it's not out of ignorance or stubbornness, because I do embrace the computer. I mean, I've always looked for better ways to make surfboards. I've been broke twice because I've put everything into what I would consider better surfboards. They're going to be better environmentally, better for the customers. And twice that backfired, mainly because of Australian difficulties to manufacture in Australia and heavy labour costs here. But no, so but what I do it because it's a dying art. And I think that an individual one-off board is still better than a computer shape. I think the basic production boards, fine, do them on a computer because you've got well-refined shapes, accurate, very nice. But there's something about the handmade board that you can tweak it for the individual guy and get it right.
So the people on the pro circuit, say the Kelly Slaters, would they have custom-made boards or not?
No, with the computer files, you're sort of custom making the computer files. You work on those files, and like on our computer, we've got 300, 400 shapes on there. And we've got individual guys' names against some of them. And you're tweaking it for that guy.
Mm.
Even though the computer does most of the work, it is custom made, but on the computer.
Yeah.
That's how Kelly would do it, which is a correct way for a professional. To have static benchmark shapes that you slowly modify and improve.
Yeah.
That's the correct logic for a pro surfer.
Mm.
Now, Kelly will ride some wild stuff as well. And he'll ride some random stuff that the guys will hand shape and give it a go.
Yeah.
And see if you can learn something from it.
So this is an article from Phil Jarrett's book. He says here that what you established was called the involvement school.
Back in the 60s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you give it that name, or was that something that was given later?
It was... I used the expression involvement in some interviews. It was about total involvement with the wave. And in 66, Nat and I did an interview for Surfing World magazine, and that word cropped up over and over again. So in time, someone else called it the involvement school after reading the interview, and it sort of stuck. And it's resurfaced in recent times.
I see.
It was the pinnacle of Australian longboarding.
Right.
Back in the first era of longboarding. That's when Nat went off and won the world contest in 66 on what we would call an involvement board.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. And as we're heading towards the 70s, were you still living that itinerant kind of lifestyle?
Very much. Yeah, very much. But I was staying in one spot longer, like say 68. I spent most of the winter here in Byron and surfing Lennox Head in the morning on the shortboards, and I'd surf longboards in the afternoon at the pass. It's 1969. Like you go to California at the end of the year, Hawaii, California for a couple of months, and I came back to Angari because when I went to the States, go back to the Cold War thing. Like the first time I went to California in 67, 68, I suddenly realised how beautiful Australia is. You know, like the lights went on, there is no... And then I started to travel more and I started to see that there's no place like the east coast of Australia. There's nothing to match it for quality of beaches, number of points, number of headlands, variety, consistency. And so I just went, bingo, this spot is insane. I'm not going to ever leave the north coast of New South Wales. It's got strong south swells with warm water, so you can ride big waves. But it's got consistent swells. Every day you can get a wave around here.
But you said Noosa was better.
When we were riding longboards only.
Oh, I see.
But when the shortboards came in, we needed more power. So I left Noosa and moved to Byron to surf Lennox Head. Lennox was empty, and it's the best big wave on the east coast. You know, it'll handle 10 feet and peel perfectly. And... then the year after 69, I went to Angari because the same deal. It's the most incredible point out there, an incredible headland, and there's no one there, so go and make the most of it. And then came 1970 after being in California and stuff. My life was getting a bit messed up then, though, because I'd gotten into drugs and I'd ended up having a brief marriage and a young daughter. And so let me suffice to say that by the end of 1970... I'd given up drugs.
What sort of drugs were you
taking? Only marijuana and LSD and psilocybin. so-called enlightening drugs.
Mushrooms and...
Mushies. And I believed that, you know, the world was upside down and everything was wrong. And so the hippie movement, you know, fully embraced it, except it was full of hippies. They were dumb. You know, and they were mostly wealthy people who could afford to go do nothing. But we were nothing like that. We were surfers living mostly, you know, half naked on the beach most of the time and living on nothing. And trying to eat local food only, because that's all you could afford, you know. It was just local bananas and whatever and local fish. And so we were living better than hippies and in Byron Bay. And, I mean, Age of Aquarius came 5 years later. Yeah, we were just lapping up the beautiful East Coast we had here. So, but I thought drugs, according to Timothy Leary, we're going to take acid and we're going to achieve nirvana. He's a liar. And he's conned. I mean, he's dead, but he was wrong. And there was no nirvana. And once I found that out, I stopped taking drugs.
And is that when you became a Jehovah's Witness?
Oh, later. It took later. Me, yeah, 3 or 4 years later.
Yeah. And is that when you met your current wife of Lynn? 38 or so years?
42, yeah. Oh, 42 years.
Excuse me.
Yeah. No, we met, been together 42 years. We've been married 40 years. Well, I grabbed my daughter from my first marriage. I came back to Australia and my first wife was messy, so I took my little 18-month daughter. So that's when my life changed. I had to do something. And I didn't become a straight guy with mortgages and children and that whole thing, but I had to look after a little girl. And her life depended on me, so I took care of her. And then I met Lynn 6 months later. And then I moved in together and she took over as mother. And we ended up having 4 more kids. So by the time Lynn was 28, she had 5 kids. So, and all the changes that brings. So the question, was I still itinerant? Hey, I'm still itinerant. Just I've been in this house for 12 years now, you know. And, yeah. But I don't know where we'll be next year.
So did you live in Byron, in the Byron area that whole time?
Yep. Well, Lennox and Byron.
Been in this area since the 70s.
Yeah, since 1970, yeah. Lennox and Byron. Yep, actually, no, 68, and then came back here on and off, and then settled down seriously here from 72 onwards, yeah, 40 years.
And is your wife a surfer?
She surfs a little, yeah. Yeah, she's, we were in the Maldives a month ago and less. She surfed about 2 or 3 hours a day over there.
And what about your kids? Are they surfers?
The two boys are. The girls all started but didn't keep it up. Yeah, the boys are great. Really good surfers.
And what do you think... my daughter surfs too in a kind of half-hearted way.
Yeah.
And she likes the retro kind of mini-mal. There's been a real resurgence in that kind of board, hasn't there?
Yeah.
For people who never develop a great set of skills when it comes to surfing but can still go out and have fun.
Fantastic boards. Fantastic boards. Now, that's, I feel one of the, I mean, people label Bob as the father of the shortboard revolution or the stowaway rebel or whatever, but I feel I've done my best work, really, in the last 15 years, 20 years. Best designs. And
what have you been doing?
Well, with the ageing population... surfers, you can see most of them are struggling on shortboards. And so I got really excited about mid-lengths, mini-mals, and although I've been making them since the shortboards came in, I've always made longboards as well. But I got really excited in the early 90s about it, and so set to redesigning longer boards, using the principles of shortboards and taking all the possible combinations out of the ether and putting them into sensible, longer equipment. And so those mini-mals can shred now. You know, they can go fast as a shortboard. They'll bank off the lip and, you know, hit the lip and carve beautiful white turns, etc. But they've got extra packaging around them to make waves easy to catch. So that was unknown out there, you know, 20 years ago. And that was the basis of McTavish surfboards coming to life as our Big M logo. It was because the older crew needed boards that still surfed great but were much easier to paddle.
And is that you too?
Yes, that's me. Yeah.
So you still surf?
Oh yeah.
Frequently?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, every day I'm checking for it, but you know, I've got other responsibilities too. I only probably surf in Australia, average now, two or three times a week.
And how do you find the crowds if you're trying to surf at, say, Bar, and there are so many people out there?
Well, I feel so sorry for beginner surfers because of the crowds. But I surf pretty much alone or with just a few people most of the time, because when you know the area well, it's just geography, and you know all the little banks that are popping. I mean, every day I'm checking all the spots, and so you know which bank's good, what tide's good, what wind's good, and my flexible schedule allows me to strike at any time when it's good. And the first thing is you don't go surfing crack of dawn anymore, because it's all school kids and tradies. And they're all snarly and angry and frustrated because they've only got an hour, you know, so you don't surf early mornings. The gentleman's hour starts at about 8:30, and that's when... The gentlemen come out and go surfing.
That's when the swimmers come and swim across the bay too, isn't
that's
it?
That's right. Yeah. Well, that's a nice time. And then around midday is another good time when there's burnout from that crew. So from midday to 2 o'clock is often really empty. 4 o'clock it starts up again with the school kids. So you've got to pick your times. When the surf gets bigger, there's no crowds. And you got to the beautiful thing about East Coast Australia is the wind shifts, because they winds circle around here like crazy. So you've got to know which spot's firing on this wind angle. And if you can, you're there to crack it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a game. It's a game of chess with the ocean. And you can get uncrowded waves.
Yeah.
And I feel sorry for newer surfers who can't read those details and don't know the area well.
And who don't receive the patience that from other surfers who are a bit better.
Well... Wattigo's, go to Wattigo's, because it's friendly. It's still got the Aloha vibe at Wattigo's. Just don't bother about the pass. Yeah, they crawl all over each other there.
Yeah.
But at Wattigo's, everyone tries to keep it a happy vibe.
Oh, good advice. On that note, we've been talking now for an hour, so it's time to finish the interview. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to comment on now? Or something perhaps I did ask you, but you don't feel you got to explain it fully enough?
I think I was born with a gift for understanding basic physical principles, and with a love for the ocean and creation, and passed on through my genes and through Dad's training. So being able to combine those two together ends up with surfboard shapes, and I'm still a shaper. You know, that I love thinking how each surfboard works in certain conditions and how those fins work. And I woke up this morning again at crack of dawn and with a little bright idea for a custom board that I'm shaping for a guy this afternoon. So yeah, it goes on. That's my calling. You know, it's no big deal for me. I was born that way, and it's not patting me on the back. It's just that I'm so fortunate that there's a thing called surfboard shaping that I happen to fall in with, because it just suits me down to the ground.
Mm.
And I still love it.
And you still obviously have the passion for surfing.
Absolutely.
Which is great.
Yeah, yeah.
And have you taken on filmmaking as well, or just involvement with other
people
making films?
No, I'm not interested. I mean, I was interested in the early
you
days
were,
in
yeah,
cameras.
In the early days.
Yeah, but no, I... No.
Yeah.
No, not, I don't want to produce any films. That's a nightmare for me, no. Surfboards are interestingly instant gratification, I suppose. You shape it, a week later it's in the water, or if you're in a real hurry, the next day, you know, you glass it roughly. So you can find out if it works or not. So that's... I'm into the stuff that works in the water. I mean, surfboards are travelling in ever-tightening spirals, so there's no hydrodynamics that applies directly to surfboards. We're making our own hydrodynamics up as we go. You know, so, but we do have to understand a lot of basic principles about planing and drag and suction and lift and induced drag and so on. So you've got to understand some basic aviation principles and apply them into our unusual little hydrodynamic spinning forms that we ride. So it's constantly challenging and always progressive, which keeps you really interested.
And do you think your someone in your family will take over the business when you decide you can't continue?
My son Ben's he's like me, he hasn't got any business brains. I mean, I've got partners, they run the business. My son Ben's got the shaping skills, and he's teaching me stuff now too because of his surfing ability. He's young and agile. I mean, he's in his mid-30s, but so he can teach me stuff now, so I can understand what Kelly Slater feels through his board, even though I can't ride a 510 any longer. I probably could if I was stuck on an island. That's the only board I had, but, you know, so my son Ben can give me all that feedback. So, yeah, he'll keep the McTavish thing going.
Oh, that's great. On that note, I'd like to thank you very much for your time this morning.
Pleasure, Leslie. Thank you.